I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. I'm sure you are familiar with the fight, flight, freeze response. It's both a psychological and physiological reaction to protect us from a perceived danger. There's another F word that some psychologists want to add to that list, and it stands for fawn. Instead of battling or running away or dissociating, when we fawn, we try to please or appease the person who is harming us. It may smooth over the threat, it may protect us temporarily, but it comes with a terrible price. Our guest today knows fawning all too well. As a teenager, Ingrid Clayton used that coping strategy growing up in a scary home. Her stepfather was sexually grooming her, while her mother did nothing to protect her. There was no way to run, so Ingrid stayed and learned to shapeshift to avoid conflict. Ingrid Clayton is now a clinical psychologist in private practice, and she's written a book about how she came to terms with her traumatic childhood and how she has treated her patients dealing with similar experiences. It's titled Fawning: Why the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. Ingrid Clayton, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
Let me read from the very beginning of your book. A couple of pages in, you write, and this is about fawning. It's not about brown-nosing for an A or sucking up to people in power. Fawning isn't conspicuous manipulation. Rather, it's a way we seek safety in the face of exploitation, shame, neglect, abuse, and other harm. Are you trying to give fawning a kind of power and purpose that maybe people don't think it has?
Absolutely. Yeah, I believe the phrasing there was it's not conscious manipulation, right? So it's not a choice. And I think as someone who was trying to climb up and crawl out from underneath this thing for a lifetime, you know, not only did I get 3 degrees in psychology, but I've sat on a lot of therapist couches, I've gone to the programs, I've read the books. And, you know, the prevailing wisdom and language on these types of behaviors, whether that was people pleasing or codependency, to name a couple, they seem to place this dysfunction, the origins of what is this dysfunctional behavior, in the individual's body, like it originated out of nowhere, and as though it was a conscious choice. And so the fawn response puts these behaviors back into the nervous system in the body. It shows the roots of these behaviors as deeply protective. And when we can acknowledge and honor that, it can start to reduce the shame, which gives us access to real help and healing. But it also puts these behaviors back in context. So in other words, I was not dysfunctional as a 13-year-old child surviving the environment that I was in. I adapted to a dysfunctional environment, right? And in that way, it's a very genius response. So I want to give it all its due.
Sure. What is the physiological experience, though, of fawning? And you describe kind of being pulled in two directions, being sort of hyper aware and sort of hypo unaware, I guess.
That's right, at the same time. So the prevailing theories are that fawning is a hybrid trauma response. So one side of that is the sympathetic fight flight nervous system response. We're adrenalized, there's a racing heartbeat. You know, this is the part of us that can attune to the environment and manage the moods and states. We're leaning in, we're appeasing, flattering, flirting, what have you, caretaking. The other end of that spectrum that's happening simultaneously, right, is the opposite end of the trauma response spectrum, is collapse or submit, where the body is literally dissociating, disconnecting from self. So in other words, in order for me to attune to you, I have to abandon the larger values or goals that I might have, because my eye is on the most safety I can get in the moment, right? In other words, I'm not noticing that there's self-abandonment. I'm noticing that my intention is to reduce the harm. So these things are happening simultaneously.
I mean, you're describing a kind of hypervigilance. Yes. I mean, I think anyone growing up in an abusive household has to always be on guard. But you're also describing sort of how to, as you say, how to almost like connect with your abuser or oppressor as a way to lower the temperature, stay out of conflict, stay out of confrontation.
That's right. Hypervigilance is one of the main signs and symptoms of fawning. We have to be hyper attuned to the external environment. Essentially, it's like I don't even have a sense of internal safety. My entire sense of safety in the world resides outside of my body. So, of course, we're scanning the horizon. We're noticing the sound of someone's keys in the door, the tiniest little, micro instances where that might let us know, oh, like it's about to turn for the worse.
Is this more common in women? And I say that I'm almost embarrassed to say that because I think stereotypically we think of women as, putting other people before themselves, of sort of downplaying themselves, even being self-critical. Do you
Yeah.
see this more in women than you do in men?
Well, we do. It's not a silly question at all. I think it also points to the fact that fawning is often conditioned, it's taught, it's expected, it's applauded. And primarily that has been to girls in childhood, right? You swap out some of the synonyms or symptoms of fawning. They could be what it means to be feminine, to be caretaking, to be sweet, right? So I have yet to find actually a woman that hasn't had at least some experience of fawning that they can relate to in their own life. And that said, it is not a gendered response that I have men in my practice. There are men that I highlight in the book that particularly with childhood trauma, it manifests similarly. So although patriarchy is one of the systems of power that we reside in, it's not the only one. We reside in many systems of power beyond the family of origin, into classism, racism. Any marginalized community is ripe for fawning.
And I'm sure people listening think, and to be perfectly honest with you, as I read through this, I felt like, well, I do that sometimes, where
Yeah,
kind of,
I do it too.
put other people first and become invisible and all the things that you described dealing with a traumatic childhood. What is the difference between sort of dealing with a situation versus trying to figure out how to survive and feel safe in a very difficult situation?
Yes, well, I think, listen, we are hardwired for relationships, and there is nothing wrong with being generous and, polite and caretaking and all of these things. The difference is that for a lot of folks, particularly that grew up with this need to fawn all the time, we don't know where we end and fawning begins. It really becomes chronic and fixed. And we might think we're being nice and generous and empathic, but we don't know the extent to which we don't exist in that equation at all. And then you have to say, well, is it generous and nice and empathic if you've gone missing, in other words. So when it's a chronic response, when it becomes maladaptive or problematic, is when you truly don't feel like you have a choice, right? There's no conscious agency in it. It's I have to lean in and privilege and prioritize you because otherwise I don't exist. I don't feel safe in the world.
Interestingly, and you mentioned this earlier, that it is paradoxically about connection, right? It's a kind of toxic connection, but help us understand the dynamic there.
Well, it's based on the only connection that's available. So I talk about it as connection as protection, and that's real. But what we also have to keep in mind is that for so many of us, this idea of just healthy, reciprocal, available attachment, it was nowhere to be seen, which is one of my other critiques about some of the historical discourse about these behaviors. It speaks to even the solutions is like, well, Marty, just set a healthy boundary and just, step in and have a voice. And it's like, you know what? Setting a boundary or trying to have a voice in this context made things worse, which is very common for a lot of folks when they tried to have a healthy fight response. It made things worse. And so I think we really have to honor the origins of the thing and the context of it. And these are the lens and language that allow us to finally make sense to ourselves, right? Why would I continue to lean into relationships that were so, with avoidant people or neglectful people or a host of other things in my own personal life? Well, it's because my body, my only sense of safety in the world, was formed in those relationships, not these healthy reciprocal relationships that we like to pretend everyone has access to.
Well, let's begin with the relationship that you had with your stepdad. You call him Randy in the book. And he came into your life when you were a teenager. You begin the book with a description of being in a hot tub with him. You were living in Colorado at the time. And at one point, and it's just the two of you, he sort of beckons you over to sit on his lap. And you realize, this is wrong. This is dangerous. Yeah. What was going on inside your head? Again, you're a young teenager, and here's this authority figure sort of trying to woo you over to his side of the hot tub.
I mean, it was deeply confusing, and so I'll say I can talk about it now after literal decades of unpacking this and many other moments from my life. What I thought for most of my life is, Ingrid, it wasn't that bad, right? There really wasn't like a lot of physical abuse like you see in other people's homes. I did what a lot of us do, which is minimize our feelings based on what we imagine was happening externally, right? If I don't have physical bruises or there wasn't X, Y, and Z, clearly it shouldn't have been that harmful. But thank goodness what we know now about complex trauma is that these invisible wounds do just the same amount of damage. But going back to the hot tub, it was the first time where I felt a sense of panic and terror when he wasn't being overtly rageful, right? So there was active alcoholism in the home. I knew that experience of hearing the tires coming down the driveway and running right before they even came in the door, because you weren't sure what was going to happen next. But to your point, he was being kind, even sweet. And so initially I was like, oh, this is maybe he wants to be friends, right? Maybe there's an open door here. It doesn't have to feel so terrible all the time. And yet it flipped pretty quickly into this feeling in my body of, I feel the same terror that I do when I'm running to my room. And yet now I'm sitting on his lap. And so this feeling of, I do not like this. I do not like him. I need him to like me. I cannot make this worse. I knew instinctively I cannot embarrass him. I can't point this out as even potentially bad behavior because I know what it's like when his switch flips, right? And so I linger longer maybe than someone might. My voice is very neutral. It's that classic appeasement that looks like I'm going along, right? The outside observer might not see anything happening there, but I tell you what, that experience stayed in my body for longer than I care to admit.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. And again, our guest today on The Connection is Ingrid Clayton. She's a clinical psychologist in private practice, and she's got a new book titled Fawning, and it's subtitled Why the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. We've been talking about some of the hallmarks of fawning and also a bit about her life as well. We're going to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation in just about a minute, so stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking about the ways that people respond to trauma. One is to be accommodating, agreeable, likable, and our guest is psychologist Ingrid Clayton. She's a clinical psychologist, and she's also the author of a new book we've been talking about titled Fawning, Why the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. Ingrid, just picking up on what you were saying before the break about being in this hot tub with your stepfather, you know, at least he wasn't yelling at you. He wasn't maybe drunk at the time. And you grew up in an alcoholic household. So wanting a relationship with him, but knowing how dangerous it was, I'm just trying to imagine being a 13 or 14-year-old teenager grappling with those competing impulses and emotions.
Yes. Well, I think one thing I haven't mentioned is that my mom, when he came into the picture, it was almost like I literally saw her disappear and she just stepped into his shadow. She would not say a thing if she almost hadn't heard him say it before, as though that validated it and gave her permission. So my primary caregiver was absent. I knew that. I also knew that although I had not seen physical abuse. I saw the evidence of it. And so, again, all of these things and being in the middle of the mountains, moving us to a town where I know nobody and you're really isolated, you know, all of these feelings led to this. My life is in this man's hands. And like all children, we are reliant on our caregivers for longer than any other species, right? So it's not an even playing field. And this is how my body adapted that environment to survive. And I'm grateful for it.
Well, I do want to get to the grateful part, but let me just put another story that you tell on the table here. Later, he takes you to Las Vegas. I believe your mother is not aware that he is doing this. He buys you what you describe as kind of grown-up clothes. He's parading you around as if you're his girlfriend. You even sleep in the same bed in the hotel, even though there's no, overt sexual contact. And again, wanting his attention, having lovely new clothes, feeling kind of grown up. That must have felt sort of weirdly enjoyable on the one hand, and yet, you have to figure out what does this guy want from me?
Yes. Well, that is an aspect of all grooming behavior, is that they find a way to essentially give you the thing that you want, which does feel very good, right? So I wanted to be a singer-songwriter, and he came back to my room when my mom was out of town with her dying father. So she was not around, nor aware. But he said, "Hey, how'd you like to go to Las Vegas? Right? I'd like to show you real shows and how it's actually done." And of course, as a budding singer, I'm like, "Well, that sounds amazing." But I didn't know it was by ourselves, and I didn't know I had to keep it a secret, right? So that stuff starts to come kind of after the fact. And sitting right next to that grooming behavior is the gaslighting. That's sort of like, "I'm not doing anything wrong. What are you even insinuating that I'm doing? I'm just being the best stepdad of all time." And of course, you know, a child who needs their caregiver, we want to believe that that's true. I want to believe that I deserve that type of attention and support and encouragement. And what often happens with childhood trauma, there's this tendency that if I need this caregiver to survive, I can't really hold even that they are that bad or that scary. And then we soak up all the shame, right? It must be me. Maybe I'm being ridiculous. Maybe I'm being over the top and selfish. And in fact, I was told those things later on when I did give voice to these incidents, right? So we come by that pretty darn honestly. So the deck is just stacked against you in those moments. He's not calling me his girlfriend out loud. He's parading me like a girlfriend. It's like my body knows, but there's no concrete evidence. You know, it's happening in this bubble. And so deeply, deeply disorienting.
I'm trying to imagine then you living your teenage life, what you look like from the outside. What did friends think? What did neighbors think? What did teachers think? Did you look like, your typical teenager? Did they have any inkling about the kind of roiling feelings that you had inside?
It's a fair question, and one that not often people ask. I think on one hand, I was vocal with my friends. You know, before I wrote Fawning, I wrote a memoir on this experience, and I went back and I talked to anyone who would listen, and I was like, "What was your experience like?" And first of all, my friends were also children. They were teenagers, they were navigating their own life. But, you know, my best friend at the time, her mom was a part of, she came and got me out of school one day and brought me into a therapist's office. You know, it wasn't uncommon for me to be crying in teachers' offices after school. I almost failed out of my freshman year in high school. Like, I started drinking very young. There was a lot of evidence that things were not going well. But when I brought all of this to light with the help of a school counselor and really had an intervention that involved social services, right? This thing that we're all told to do, like speak up for yourself, right? Marty, it went so horribly bad that my mom not only doubled down on her denial, she wouldn't even look at me or speak to me. She said, "We need to call him in right now," right? He was not initially invited into this meeting.
And this is
And
Randy, your
this is
stepdad.
Randy. Yeah. And so he, you know, came bounding into the room and called me a liar, said I made it all up. And his story was really privileged. So now I've called it out, and where I used to get the silent treatment sort of intermittently, sometimes for months at a stretch, which being a ghost in your own home is also horrifying. And in contrast, Vegas was a lot more fun, let's
Sure.
be real. But after that point in time, I am just dead to this man, right? I do not exist. And yet he still has to drive me to school every day. I mean, it was horrific, right? So the few good times that I used to have along the way are now completely gone. And I know that I have a mother who neither protected nor believed me. I mean, it was excruciating.
It sounds excruciating. You describe also shape-shifting, this how you had to play certain roles depending on who you were with or the situation that you're in. I think all of us do that to some degree, but it felt as if, as you write about it, that you're really your life depended on your ability to play act your way through life.
Well, there's an attempt to even preserve the good times. So certainly you think about this relationship with my stepdad, the last thing I want to do is be near him. But he was also a musician. So if he's inviting me to sing and even sing these love songs, these duets, it's the last thing I want to do. But I stood right next to him and I sang my heart out and I made sure that I matched my voice ever so sweetly with his. That's an aspect of that shape-shifting quality, right? So we're trying to prolong the good times. We're trying to minimize the bad. It's sort of, we're the court jesters and, you know, a lot of childhood trauma survivors, we sort of come by our comedic tendencies, honestly, right? You're trying to just lighten the mood. So yeah, it has a lot of different presentations, as many as there are contexts, right? It's sort of, who do I need to be in this moment to survive it? And we are talking about surviving it relationally, because we need these other people to meet very vital needs in our lives. And you could even extend that to the workplace and bosses, and, you know, you need a paycheck. There's lots of different places that this shows up, certainly.
You even describe being a flirt. I mean, that was one of the ways that you knew to,
right,
I guess, relate to men, but also just to ingratiate yourself with other people.
I think that's one of the most painful presentations, if I'm honest, that, you know, fawning kind of co-opts these instincts, these natural even assets, whether it's your empathy or your generosity. But as someone who was so deeply sexualized so young, my body also learned that while I'm disempowered, oh, I have some currency by my being attractive, or if you are sexually interested in me. So again, without my conscious awareness or consent, those parts of me came online in countless, countless other situations well into my adult life. And I thought, why is this happening again? Right? Well, now I know it's the seed of trauma reenactment, and deeply, deeply shameful, which is another reason why I'm talking about it, because I know how many people have felt this way. And I want them to know it's not their fault. They didn't do anything wrong. It makes perfect sense, even for me in that situation, that I would lead with that once I left that house. My body didn't know any different.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Ingrid Clayton. She's a clinical psychologist, and she's got a new book. It's titled Fawning, Why the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. It's in part about her own life growing up with a difficult, shall we say, or even abusive stepfather, and a kind of AWOL mother, an absent mother, and how she learned to ingratiate herself in order to stay safe in the home, but also how that affected her as she moved out and became an adult and had relationships with grown-ups herself. Well, let me talk to you about the fact that you, as you say, you ended up dating or living with the same person, they just had a different face, that you were recreating what sounded like this relationship that you had with your stepdad, with all these various boyfriends who were in and out of your life.
Yes. So it's an unfortunate feature that if my whole sense of safety was really developed, my blueprint, in other words, for safety is I know what it's like and how to defend myself in the face of exploitation or neglect. That this is what I found myself in over and over again, was in relationships with people who were either exploiting me or totally unavailable, right? And it's like, It was my chemistry. And in fact, it felt exciting. We see this a lot in the attachment literature. It's sort of like people are like, but I'm not attracted to healthy people, right? Like that feels deeply boring. And this other piece, it feels very exciting. And now we know that if it has that kind of crazy chemistry, the chances are it's not a healthy chemistry at all. It's likely unresolved attachment wounds. But of course, I didn't know that for many, many years.
Sure. You call it trauma bonding. That's what it's called, trauma
There's
bonding.
an aspect of trauma bonding, yes, where there's intermittent reinforcement. Sometimes there's good times and sometimes there's bad times. And the fawn response in that equation is sort of, again, helping me to prolong the good times, believe that they're always right around the corner. But ultimately, trauma bonding is likened to sitting at the slot machine, right? Where you're throwing in your life savings, going, but this time I'm going to hit the jackpot. This time I'm going to win. And unfortunately, many of us don't. I talked about it as like we're left sort of hoping, helping, and waiting forever.
What did you do with all that fear, anger, anxiety? What did
That's
you
such a
what
great
what did
question.
what did what did you do with that?
Well, initially I drank, and you can see why I turned to alcohol or substance. For a lot of people, it's, eating disordered, all kinds of coping. You can see why the coping becomes so necessary. But I also talk about with fawning in particular, it's not like we aren't resentful. It's not like we aren't mad. We can't tell you about it. And so sometimes where this, it leads to self-harming behaviors. It leads to even gossiping. It's like all that pent up energy has to go somewhere. And it can't be direct with the person, that I'm upset with, but I can kind of talk behind their back, or it's just, it's seeking some form of expression. So ultimately, getting in touch with our anger, with our resentment, with our anxiety, even. Most fawners don't know that we're anxious. We're so anxious, but we don't know that we're anxious because, again, we're not attuned to our own body. I'm attuned to your body. I know when you're anxious. I know when you're upset. So part of this longer healing work is tuning in fully to ourselves, maybe for the first time ever, and growing this relationship to self.
Is it a form of dissociation?
Yes. Yes, that's the hypoarousal aspect of fawning. And it can vary, again, by person and by context, because sometimes you have a sense, like I did, that I did not like my stepfather. But sometimes the dissociation and sort of the belief that this is a good person, and we sort of, endow them with all kinds of resources and values that they don't even necessarily have, it can really make us write this whole story that this is a fantasy of this isn't dysfunctional, right? This is my person. There's a lot of storytelling that can go along with the fawn response that unfortunately can really keep us stuck.
Well, you say an interesting thing about storytelling and even about lying, which as you said, you did, but that there was always some kind of truth in those lies, that, maybe the content was wrong or incorrect, but the emotion had a kind of resonance. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, I just think when I talk about lying in this context, again, it's not conscious manipulation. And it's not for no reason, right? That my lying, even if you look at my standing next to my stepdad singing these songs and being like, that sounded great, right? There's a performance that's necessary to preserve my sense of self at all. And I think that goes missing when there is, a discourse out there that fawning is just conscious manipulation. And I just don't agree. I don't, having lived in that for so long, and quite frankly, watching so many clients also climb and crawl out of this thing, they're not inherent liars. They're also not inherently people who would shrink or get small or be people pleasers. These are necessary adaptations, and that's really the reverence that I'm holding in throughout all of the signs and symptoms.
You mentioned your brother in your book. What, I mean, is there, I'm assuming now you talk to him about what your childhood is like. And all of us growing up in a family, we all have different childhoods, even if we have the same home and the same family. But how did you see him reacting to what was going on in the home?
Yeah, I think that, just what you said is my exact personal experience that every child, and my stepdad had three other biological children from two previous marriages, one I lived with. So I grew up with my biological brother and my stepbrother. And absolutely, each of us had a very different experience growing up. Mine was unique as a young girl, certainly. But I will say, particularly when I was deciding to publish my memoir, I did go and talk to all of my siblings and step siblings, and particularly my step siblings, knowing that so much of my work was going to be about their dad. They all said, my experience may have been different, and I'm not saying better or worse, quite frankly, but they really gave me their blessing, and they said, "This is your story, and you need to tell it, and I can understand why." So that is so meaningful to me. And my biological brother would say the same, right? He had a very different experience, but he also had his own coping in his own way that, that took him some places that I'm sure he wished weren't the case.
About a minute before a second break here, I'm picking up on that. I mean, what is the impact of secrets on a family, on the inside of a family?
It's corrosive. I mean, there's a million different implications that addiction was certainly one of them. It's a long line of my family tree of people who turn to substances. I will say my biological brother now is also sober. That's a great gift. And I celebrated 30 years of sobriety 2 days ago.
Good
So
for you.
I'm very, very proud of that. It's been foundational to being able to do the rest of the work. So there's a lot to uncover. It's layer after layer after layer. But for me, fawning was one that covered so many bases that that helped me to be the most free. So I'm glad we're talking about it.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Dr. Ingrid Clayton. She's a clinical psychologist with a private practice and now she's an author. Her book is titled Fawning, which is what we're talking about, and it's subtitled Why the Need to Please May excuse me, Why the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. We'll be talking about how she found her way back after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and if you're just joining us, Ingrid Clayton is our guest. She's a clinical psychologist in private practice. She's a childhood trauma survivor. She has a blog that she writes for Psychology Today called Emotional Sobriety, and she's got a new book we're talking about called Fawning, and it's subtitled Why the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. Well, as you describe it, Ingrid, you went to a lot of therapies and various different forms of treatment, but there was something about learning about fawning that seemed to just resonate with you and maybe explain a lot of what we've been talking about. What was that? Was it a light bulb moment or just a realization, oh, this is what I've been doing?
Well, I think I had been trying to understand what my experience was. I was even writing about it before I knew it had this other name of the fawn response, and that it hadn't quite been contained by the codependency literature or even the literature on people pleasing. And then I heard the term. It was coined by Pete Walker. He's a psychotherapist and complex trauma survivor himself. And I just loved that it finally put all of these behaviors in the lens and language of trauma. And so I, even though I'm in the mental health field, am like a lot of other people, right? Even when I went to graduate school and did my subsequent training, we were still thinking of trauma simply as these acute events, these obvious big events that everyone can agree are traumatic. And what we now know is that these experiences, like we've been discussing here, whether it's emotionally immature parents or unavailability or active addiction, these types of relational threat over time can create the same pattern of wounding in the body. And this trauma response was a result of that. So, whereas for a long time I could not use the word trauma to describe my own experience, I mean, it's almost interesting to me now, even hearing your introduction, because I lead with that. Ingrid is a childhood trauma survivor.
That's right.
That was not available to me. I would have been mortified if you had said it out loud. I would have thought all those things that they told me I was being, oh, you're so ridiculous and over the top and selfish. So a big part of fawning then, it allows me to claim and own and validate what was initially a deeply traumatic situation. And this type of validation is so crucial for so many relational trauma survivors because otherwise, what we're doing is we're waiting for the people that harmed us to validate our pain. And guess what? It's largely not going to happen. And then the fawn response is needed yet again, right? To continue to manage these harmful and ongoing relationships. So it's very tied to what we know about complex trauma. And it just mapped out over my experience like nothing else had. It reduced the shame, which is so crucial, I think, in any healing work. It stopped blaming me and being like, well, Ingrid, why would you flirt, right? You could sort of look at that as an example and be like, well, why would you flirt with that boss? It's like, because it was my only sense of safety in the world, and it was not intentional. I was not even aware necessarily that I was flirting. So it was a lot to unpack, but I finally could when you went back to the roots of trauma, because now I have to reprocess what happened. All the other advice is just let it go. The past is in the past. Just forgive. That's the answer, right? If that worked, Marty, I would be shouting it
Sure.
from the mountaintop. But I tried and I tried. Earnestly, I did, right? Spirituality and all these different other modalities. And those things kept me stuck.
You have used the word shame several times during this interview. No, I find it I mean, shame, even the word shame feels so shameful.
I
There's
know.
something about that word, but in terms of the sort of chronic abuse and being a childhood trauma survivor, what is the shame about? I mean, did you feel like somehow you were responsible for what your stepfather was doing to you?
Yes, and it's very, very common with relational trauma that, I say worth, our very worth is the wound. Okay, so this idea that not only was I being pursued in this way, but that when I did finally ask for help from the person who was supposed to love me more than anyone was not available. It is this deep, deep wound that says, I must not be worthy, right? We soak up the shame for the whole system as though we could kind of metabolize it in our own body. And yet you can't. You cannot metabolize someone else's shame. You have to kind of put their piece back in their lap in order to be free of it. So first there's the wound of what happened. Boom. Then there's the piece where maybe we try to take care of ourselves. I think every single client in my experience, in my book has this example where they did try to ask for help. They did turn to other people and no help was there. Okay. So boom, the shame takes another turn. It's like, what was I thinking? Of course I shouldn't have, given a voice to this thing. And then lastly, the way that we're responding to these ongoing traumas. I knew on some level that I was betraying my larger values, that I did not want to shape shift in this way, that I was hitting the ceiling and not being able to be as authentic and free or bring my whole self to the world. That is so deeply painful. And all of that combined is just this, deep, deep shame spiral. I think it makes sense that I've brought it up so many times in different contexts.
Indeed. And as you say, one of the hallmarks of fawning is to be conflict avoidant, which is to
That's
do almost anything in order to avoid confrontation or conflict. So how did you learn to engage in so-called, healthy conflict? How were you able to, to not be afraid of disappointing somebody else by disagreeing with them? How did you manage that, or how are you managing that?
Yeah, I think there was a real tipping point essentially when my stepdad died, right? So here I am in my mid-40s at that point. And when he died, I felt safer on this earth than I had ever felt before. I mean, it was visceral immediately. And it did return me to myself in ways that just were not accessible while he was still alive. That's real. So when we say the body keeps the score, that's what we mean, that it didn't matter to some extent how earnestly I'd been trying, right? I needed him to be gone in order for me to be a bit safer. But once that did happen, I was called to write my own story and to do it in a way, initially secretly, sort of quietly, just for myself. But when I finally saw my own experience, not just in childhood, but my first marriage and on, as a trauma therapist, Marty, I finally saw in black and white. I had just enough distance from my own story to see it through a trauma therapist's eyes. And I thought, this is what this is. No therapist had named complex trauma for me before. No one had named fawning. But I knew enough about these things that I could finally own these terms for myself. And it's now what I give to my clients. I give them the proper language, the proper paradigm to see their experience. And it unlocks all of the help that we know is available, which is tends to be different from traditional talk therapy, right? These are embodied modalities. I did for myself what I now do for my clients.
Are you a different person today?
100%. Yes. And if people that have known me a long time, they go, no, Ingrid, you've always been this way. But because I was even always a performer, a singer-songwriter, right? They're maybe not surprised that I could speak to you on the show today, but I could not speak to you on the show about things so deeply real and personal. And that is the piece that has changed, that whereas shame was in the driver's seat, fawning was in the driver's seat, I am more me at all times than I have ever been in my whole life. And despite all of the pain that you have to walk through to heal, which is also real, right? There's a lot of grief, there's a lot of unpacking, there's a lot of pain. I can say without a doubt it is 100% worth it, because I would rather have me in my own life finally than honestly anybody else. So if anybody else isn't meant to kind of stay on this journey with me, well, so be it, because I'm finally here.
You describe an incident, and I think, being a parent will push many, many buttons, but you
Oh
describe,
boy.
oh boy, is right. You describe your son having a temper tantrum and being really angry and, doing what young children will do from time to time, and
Yeah.
how resentful you were because as a kid, you were not allowed to express yourself that way. I thought that was just a really interesting description that you have of this conflict and how it just tapped into some, maybe unresolved conflicts that you had about your own childhood as a kid growing up.
Yes, it's so common. I think that people only start to get a sense of their unresolved complex trauma when they become a parent, because it's so deeply triggering. And this was one for me that consciously, right, present tense me knew that my son was just being a toddler and that it was my job to sort of hold space for that and not get pulled in and to be able to co-regulate. I could not do it to the extent that I knew I needed to do. And to your point, it not only invited this, like, come on, kid, do the thing that I had to do. There was this really almost gross primitive feeling. It was like it was my turn to be at the top of the food chain and to, in terms of another system of power, I'm finally at the top. I mean, it's horrific. I can't believe I'm saying it out loud, but it's real. And
We
I
can
know I'm not.
relate, believe me, we can relate.
So I felt that, but also my lack of capacity. If you think about conflict avoidance, essentially, my kid is like, ugh, like this is conflict, and my body's like, don't know how to hold that and lean in a way that doesn't inspire actual terror in me, right? So that happened right around the same time as my stepdad died. So it was kind of this perfect storm of like everything in my life finally sort of like. The lights were blaring, like, this is what this is. You can't deny it anymore, right? And I'm again grateful for that.
Do you know your body better than you used to?
Oh my goodness, yes. And I trust it. I trust it because I trust myself. I trust my gut. I trust what I'm feeling, right? It doesn't mean we act on every feeling all the time, but I can be present to myself. Like I could not be present to my son and not only practice presence with him in a remarkably different way, I can be present to the storms and the tantrums in me, which is what allows them to resolve, right? If every time I was feeling that because, oh, you can't let that out, you can't sort of bring it out into the world, where's it going to go? So it just gets stuffed away and stuffed away. I can metabolize that stuff now. It's remarkably different.
You describe your family with this stepfather who was grooming you, and your mother who was either in denial or certainly not there for you, didn't protect you, did not believe you. You basically have cut off contact with her, except for maybe very sporadically. Was that to protect yourself from just all those feelings that you had growing up? Does she feel like a dangerous person to you?
Well, I think particularly when I was writing my memoir, just like I talked to all my siblings, I kept going back to my mom and saying, can we finally have a conversation about this? I cannot continue to be in relationship with you if I know that you don't believe me. Like, he's gone now. Can we finally have the conversation? And she was incapable of doing it. And then I waited, because that's what we do. Okay, I'll give her more time, right? And so it was even 3 more years later. And I was like, okay, can we have the conversation now? And basically the answer was no, that I got back sort of these platitudes that a lot of people get, which is like, the past is in the past. And there was no meeting me where I needed to be met. And so, yes, at that point in time, my body knew abundantly. I am putting myself in harm's way by continuing to relate to a person who sees me as so deeply flawed and to blame, right? That doesn't know me at all, as a matter of fact. And so real space was necessary for a real period of time. And because I feel safer in my own body and in the world and can set boundaries differently, I'm finding maybe there's room for them to be a bit more permeable, particularly as it relates to my son, who would like a relationship with his grandmother, right? She's not overtly harmful to him in any way. So it's an ongoing, as it is with a lot of us, right? It's ongoing, but I just really trust my process and my needs. That comes first. And that never came first. It was always everybody else came first.
We've been talking about trauma and dealing with a traumatic childhood, but I'm thinking about fawning and the workplace, where there are hierarchies. Some people have more power than others. And sometimes you do go along to get along, or you do sort of go through some of the behavior of fawning because you want to get stuff done and you don't want to make waves necessarily. Is that a bad thing to do?
I don't think it's a bad thing. I need a paycheck, right? There's often times where we're going into the lion's den, it feels, and we got to sort of go in so we can get out. And it's very personal, right? I also think from an instinctual level, it's not about never fawning again. I'm always going to have a body, so I'm always going to have a fight, flight, freeze, or fawn response available to me. The point is to not live in a survival response 24/7, whether we sense threat or not. And that's what happens with chronic fawning. I'm now fawning with people that are the safest people in my life. I just don't even know what it's like to bring my full self into relationships. So it's so healing is deeply personal. It looks different for every single person. But to your point, this question about my sense of agency and being in my body, that's now my compass. And my hope is that everyone else gets to restore the relationship to their compass, where they go, yeah, I'm fawning for my boss, but guess what? I'm actually even doing it with a sense of agency, knowing I'm doing it for a reason. And then I leave and I go be in my life and I'm a whole person and I have access to me. I say that's fair.
We're almost out of time here. It almost feels unfair to ask you this question, but do you think a country can fawn? And by that, I mean appease and please its leadership in order to get along?
100%. It's any system of power. And boy, that's at the top of the food chain, isn't it? Any system of power with marginalized people, disempowered people is ripe for fawning.
Well, we have to leave it there. Ingrid Clayton, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. And thanks for your honesty talking about your life and this important issue. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Marty.
And again, Ingrid Clayton's new book is called Fawning, Why the Need to Please Makes Us Lose Ourselves and How to Find Our Way Back. And she is a clinical psychologist in private practice. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.